You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Ginger Hendler. She's talking to me from her studio in New York. Ginger, thanks so much for being with me today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
Ginger, let's talk about what you're working on now. What's happening at the moment in your studio? And then, of course, I want to talk about your past. But what's happening in your studio now?
Okay, well, I'll give you a good idea of what's happening in my studio. Right now, I'm down here looking at a kind of a mixed media plate of interesting three-dimensional pieces and paintings, and they're all surrounding me, and I came here to be inspired by what I have made in the past and recently, but I haven't been doing a lot of actual painting or work because I'm involved in this performance, the production that I created, which is more three-dimensional than I ever thought. I mean, it's into the fourth dimension and the fifth dimension, so last year was its debut, and the title of it is The Adventures of Gingerella, and it did come from a painting. It is a 17.5-foot painting that I created at an artist residency about 4 or 5 years ago. And from that, I wrote a story, and after that, I self-published the book in the same name. And then I felt that it needed to be performed. I felt that since the book itself lent itself to some kind of a chorus and some type of an opera, and so I called it an opera or a fable. And there were moments where there was a Greek chorus that sounded, that sounded right. So I started working on a production. And I found myself a musical director and a choreographer and a director, and the whole thing got a lot bigger than I ever could have imagined. It was just overwhelming. So I put aside some of my actual painting, although they continued sporadically, so I could get my production together. And it was about 4 years in the making. So I sit here with my paintings surrounding me, and I'm in a couple of group shows which I had work for. One of them was with 27 other artists who all studied with this one master teacher who just recently died at 94, so it was kind of like an homage to him, but really it was supposed to be just he and friends, people who loved and, saw him as a mentor. And so then it became kind of a memorial for him. So I'm getting myself geared up to putting some paint on a canvas and starting up with a new bunch of paintings.
And to talk briefly about Gingerella, before we maybe go backwards about some of the seeds of that, it sounds like such a huge production to put together and so large. I can imagine it would take 4 years to put together. But can you tell me a little bit about the story and also how the production, where was the last place it was shown? So just briefly, the story and the last place it was shown, so we can get a sense of how it, what it's about.
Okay, thank you for asking. It's something that brings a lot of light and joy and energy into my life right now, and it has for the past few years. But since I went away to the Vermont Studio Center, which is in Johnson, Vermont, and I was there for 2 weeks, and I brought with me a 17.5-foot roll of unstretched canvas. So I had gone up with the awareness or understanding that I wasn't pre-thinking. I wasn't thinking through what I was going to do in advance. I was just going to be spontaneous, and I was scared. I didn't have any idea what I was going to do, and I realized that I hadn't planned anything, and I just had this big, beautiful expanse of studio space that they offer you, you know, for your stay. And you get a room, and you get food, and you get a studio. And that was just a dream. And nobody there to bother you. And there were other artists and writers. That's all they cater to. So so I unrolled my canvas, and I initially thought I would cut them into segments and do smaller pieces. But then I left it open, and I just, you know, unfurled it, and it was a huge space. I could have unfurled two or three of them lengthwise. So I had some beautiful gesso, this dark Venetian red, and I just covered the entire canvas with this Venetian red paint, and it kind of reflected India to me. And I had been to India before the residency, so I was feeling all of that in my brain. I mean, it was whirling around, the colors and the gorgeousness of Indian people and the colors of the architecture, the colors of the buildings, just the deepness, the depth of the reds and the ochres. And so I just painted it, and then the story unfolded. And I don't, honestly, I think about where it came from, but I don't have any memories of having thought about it much. So there was a world that kind of unfolded, this very kind of unknown, untouched world that had within its forest these two-legged, one two-legged actually. There was only one two-legged, and that was Gingerella, who appeared later. So Gingerella came floating into this world, and she was kind of like an avatar, or I can't quite think of the other term for her, but she was like my inner child, so to speak. And I hadn't really thought about it at all, so it just was like this long story that unfolded. And I must have written some of it down in some way, because I remember that on the borders of all, and remember, this is an unstretched canvas, so it had no, it didn't have, so I covered it with gesso, so that was, you know, the first coat, which covered up all the empty holes. Because canvas just absorbs everything, and I, after I finished it all, I took a pen. I think it was a Sharpie or something, and I just wrote many of the words from the story around the border in just a black Sharpie. So I had no plans to frame it. I couldn't imagine. I still can't imagine that being framed. So usually it just gets tacked up. So anyway, back to the story. It's all the two-legged, there was the characters that came into the story were a crocodile, the giraffe, the Indian cow, and there was Ganesh, the Indian god Ganesh, and I think that's it. I think there was no elephant, just a giraffe, and so they were all her family, her friends, and they all had a great sense of compassion and empathy, which is the basic premise of this story, is how can we all get along with peace and loving kindness. And you know, it started early. It started before 2016, and I won't get into politics at all. But it was a wonderful fable about what the world can be. And I realized that this is what I truly believe, and it goes back into my childhood, that I didn't know why it was so difficult for people to get along. And so this kind of just appeared in the on the canvas, and it was filled with lotus flowers and trees, and the entire canvas has it's kind of done in little as I said, there would have been segments, but instead the segmented part was the trees that kind of divided, almost like they were scenes. So you've got the crocodile at the end, and you know, there are all these at the stake. There was a snake. There is a snake. So all of these characters were in the show. They all came to life, and so it's really all about learning to talk non-judgmentally without injury. And there is some reference symbolically to a lot of Mahatma Gandhi's work. And then I went to see a play, which was a great inspiration and influence, which was an opera called Satyagraha, and it was done by Philip Glass, and it was magnificent, and it was huge. It was very, very impressive. And at that point, I thought it would be so easy to just divest of all, you know, material things and just become at one with yourself, at peace with yourself, and live in a state of loving kindness and, you know, not having worldly goods that would taint you in any ways. So that was really what it started with.
And where is it produced? Like, I mean, that's clear. How was the first production done, or maybe the latest production? How was the last?
Well,
it
was only one. I have only done it once. We came to the point where we were ready to perform it, and we got a small church. What it had been a church, it is no longer a church. So it was desanctified. It had beautiful windows, and we found it, and we all thought that it was like really glorious and perfect. Perfect for this production, not because it had been a church, but it was just a beautiful space.
So where was that space?
That space is in a small town on Long Island called Glenwood Landing, and it was actually transformed into this place that was being used for. It was called the Glenwood Life Center, and it was being used for yoga and theater and you know, kind of well-being, wellness things, Tai Chi, and wonderful things. So it just kind of fit into my whole idea of where it should be and how it should be and what the environment would be like. So it's really amazing. It just kind of fit in. And we had a lot of work to do. So we had auditioning. We had to get together with all these people and have rehearsals, and we rented the space for rehearsals, and, you know, we had to make some money. I did a Kickstarter fund, and it actually wound up, we did not meet our goal, so I was a little panicky, but somehow we made it. You know, we just got through people, and we had nights. We did it for 6 nights. And one afternoon, and that was it. So now we're doing it again. We have a debut, actually. The other was a debut as the kind of semi-opera, but this one we've revised into kind of a concert version. So we're doing it more as just pieces, songs, dance numbers, and text, and it will be a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood. We were invited to do the show at a nightclub that had been famous in the 70s and the 60s called My Father's Place. And My Father's Place is in Roslyn, New York. And it was very popular for very big music acts. You know, a lot of very famous people were there. And people stood round the block trying to get in. So, you know, I was honored to be asked to do this and to do it as a Planned Parenthood fundraiser. So that's what we're doing now.
That is exciting. And so the book is one way that people can still enjoy the story.
Right.
without the production. And where is that book available? I mean, there'll be links in this article.
That book is actually available on Amazon, and through me. But Amazon is still selling it. It's called The Adventures of Gingerella, a fable, an opera. But if you look up Gingerella, you'll find it, and it's still there. So because I self-published it, it's also called published on. It's on demand, so there are no copies in advance. You order it, and they make it.
Right.
So it's kind of neat. It's made in all languages. That's very exciting for me. At first, I tried very hard not to self-publish it because I thought there was something about what might be called vanity press. But I decided it was a good way to go because I really wanted it in print, and I wanted to do it. So I forged through, which was very difficult. I think, when you said it's a big job in 4 years, and before that I had an art installation in Riverhead, New York, which was also a combination of my other paintings and the painting of Gingerella. So that was the main focal point. But it was a very interesting experience. And I learned that is nothing that comes without hard work. So that was my first kind of eye-opening experience.
And then let's go back to what seems like a seminal kind of eye-opening experience for you, which it seems like all this is draws from in some way, which was your first trip to India. Can you tell me a little bit about that first trip and how that impacted this work? I mean, I guess it's obvious how it impacted, but I'd like to hear about that first trip to India, because I know that's a big part of your story and what happened after that.
I don't even know how this all came about, but it was it feels like magic when I think about it. And, sometimes you just don't know where things are going to come from that influence you and make up, this is just a huge piece of my life. So, and it didn't come as a younger person, because as a younger person, I was too busy trying to figure everything out. And then I was a teacher, and I said, it's time to do something else. So I retired, or I resigned, and I just, played around for a while trying to figure out different things, and then I started focusing on this. So that's when I first got brave enough to start calling myself an artist, because I hadn't really had the experience. I thought, well, that's not what it's all about. So I have some friends that I have a lot of artist friends, and one woman who is from India was looking to start a group to go to India and go to her, and she was going to lead the tour. So I think it was six of us went with her, and her brother-in-law, who was living in India, he actually put the tour together. So it was like a dream come true. I think I mentioned in something I sent to you that I had been very influenced by Indian artifacts, because my mother had this love for Morocco and India and all these rich colors, and I think she was a colorist and an artist. And she loved India. She had elephants all over the house, and it was very, mirrored cloth, if you can imagine all of that, and a lot of the lamps and things. There were Buddhas. She actually carved a Buddha at the Art Students League when she was younger. She went there and she carved it out of some beautiful wood. And so it was kind of a natural thing, and I didn't realize how important it would be to me. But being with our other friends who were artists, and that was the main goal, was to see just seeing everything through an artist's eye. And I fell in love with the Indian miniatures, and also with the architecture, the mosques, the temples. They're just so gorgeous, and the people. It was like going back in time. It's like seeing these beautiful wrinkled elder people that looked like they had come out of some old classical world. And, you know, this is still the way they, you know, there are all these young, modern kind of Indian hipsters, I want to say, but then there's the poverty that also kind of reflected quite seriously into my kind of mind. I call it in the book, it's like a mind maze. I make up words, which is fun.
So that influenced you. I mean, coming back from the India trip, what happened next? Because these were all influences for the book and the production.
Right. So I guess what happened next was that I went to the residency in Vermont, and I spent 2 weeks by myself just working on this painting. And then we had, at the end of the residency, there's usually an exhibit, and it's an open studio kind of process where everybody's invited. And I had always been quite shy about my work. You know, I never considered myself an artist, and I wasn't really going about showing off my work because I never thought I was an artist and didn't really have much to say in the way of statements. And I just, you know, I doodled as a child, and I was creative, and I was skilled at doing things. I could copy very well, but I never really thought much about doing anything. I wanted to be a writer and an actor. So now I see that everything has kind of come full circle in that sense. So the theatricality of the whole thing obviously was very important because it became a theater piece. And I always want to take my work to another level. It's not enough for me to paint. Painting seems like something you do as a background or something that you work from, and you can add to it. I've had the art instructor that recently passed away used to look at me with disdain when he saw me add on certain types of things, certain types of what I call embellishments. But to a purist, you know, you don't embellish painting. You just, you know, so these people just, they're aghast. And I just loved putting things onto my art and whatever they were. So I have some favorite artists that are... like there's an artist named Nick Cave. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
For sure, yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I love his sound suits and all his wonderful craziness, and he's so amazing. And his theme of, you know, this anti, this underlying, you know, we are all the same and do not judge each other by our color or our, you know, so don't look at each other because you're enclosed in this wonderful costume that covers your body and your hair, and nobody can predict or stereotype you. So that's the kind of thing that I seem to be gravitating towards. So that's why I like to travel, because it gives you a chance to rid yourself of all these preconceived notions that exist so much in our world. People, there's just so much hatred, and I was just talking about that this morning. Like, it's so hard to understand that after so many years of having this planet being inhabited by two-legged, you know, creatures that have brains that are supposed to be advanced brains, and we still haven't figured out peace. So
it is incredible, and it's a remarkable story that you're telling, and I think such an important message. You're right today, and tomorrow, and it's always been it's such an important story for us to hear now. I wanted to ask you one more thing. I know in reading about your life and your story that you also had a stroke that also seemed to be a life-changing moment. Do you mind talking about that a little bit?
And that's what brought me to you in the first place. And I signed up for things in your praxis center, and I had a stroke recently, right before I signed up, and I contacted you because I wanted to enhance my my whatever ability to be seen, to have my work seen, and to further emerge into the world and get my work out there. And you had some wonderful ideas about going into museums and who to contact and all that. But I was very inept. I had lost my ability. Well, I never had a great sense of technology. It wasn't my thing. I'm totally one side, one brain. But I had to back out of the course because I was not able to keep up with whatever I was doing. I couldn't figure out how to. The stroke was a huge awareness for me of what can happen. So really, a lot of people who face these, whether it's cancer or some kind of, anything that affects your brain and your ability to move, and all of a sudden you're faced with this kind of awareness that you've got to do things now. So that was when I continued to work on Gingerella, because every Friday I would have a production meeting with my collaborators, and they were so helpful in keeping me going. I mean, I would invite them to my house on a weekly basis and make lunch, and we would all eat together, and then we would work on the project. So it was a very wonderful collaborative effort, and it kept me going. I was fraught with anxiety, and I couldn't paint. Everything hurt. My body hurt when I tried to paint. I remember my husband told me, well, why don't you just go downstairs and open up your paints, and that might be a start to getting back into your work. And I went downstairs, and I literally could not open up a jar of paint. It hurt too much. It was really challenging. Picking up the brushes, going in to get water for my water holder, my jar, and staying down there for like 15 minutes at a time. I had read a book at that time. I don't think I've read too many books since then. But the book that I read was not a great work of art, but it was a book by Elizabeth Gilbert called, the recent book that she wrote on Miracle, something like that. Mm. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But it was geared toward artists. It was nonfiction. And in the book, she mentioned something. She said, if you're having a dry spell for whatever reason and you're having difficulty getting into your studio, imagine that your work, imagine that going into your studio is like meeting a lover. And you go into your studio for 15 minutes, and it's like meeting your lover and, an assignation or something for 15 minutes or 20 minutes. And I tried that, and it actually worked. It made it so, so much less pressure for me. So I've still not totally resolved all the issues that I have. I've slowed down a lot, but I did 9 paintings. The stroke was in December of 2016. So since then I did 9 paintings that I have recently had framed, and I'm going to have a small show in a local gallery in June. And I have one more show coming up in May where I'll put 2 of those paintings and some other paintings that I have. So that's the story of my stroke, but it led me to other things. It led me to collaborating with people, knowing that I couldn't do it all by myself. And that's the beautiful thing about theater, is that you depend on others. So
The collaborative forum, yeah, is.
But the thing that was really special was that I had touched base with other people who loved my vision. They shared my vision, which was even, you know, the most special thing. And it was what brought them to life, because they were, it was like six characters in search of an author. You know, they were like five people, five choreographer, two musical collaborators, and a director. They all came through. There were people who did scenery. They all came, they were all searching for a project, and I was it. I provided that for them.
Yeah, that is amazing, and it's yeah, of course, very, very inspiring to hear your story, and your recovery continues. Obviously, you're not there yet, but it
yes.
sounds like you're getting better, and that also changed the way you're looking at work, as you're saying. A stroke is life-altering experience to go through. That sounds like it really changed the way you're looking at your work.
It absolutely does. I mean, I think so many things have changed because of that moment, or several days of stroking. And it's interesting. I just thought of the word stroke in terms of painting, you know, like connecting the words to two different, totally different things. But the painter's stroke and the invisible stroke that comes to pass in different ways. But so the stroke that I had really deeply impacted the way I look at my life and the world and time. And, you know, it's all part of the imagination. So, I mean, it's real the way we want it to be real, but it's very much part of, you know, it's a dream. It's you talk about the Museum of Non-Visible Art. Is that what it is?
Right. Yes.
Well, this is kind of like all of life is the Museum of Non-Visible Art.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to ask you one more question, which I always ask everybody. What are you reading at the moment? And I also wanted to say that the book that you mentioned by Elizabeth Gilbert, was that Big Magic?
Yes, that's what it is. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
You're welcome.
Yeah,
and what are you reading now?
I'm reading very little, but in my mind I have many, many books that are on my list. But if I could tell you what I kind of remember reading, would that be okay?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. I remember that all my life I wanted to read Ulysses and Proust. I wanted to read more James Joyce, and I wanted to read Remembrance of Things Past. So when I was in, this was quite a few years ago, when I was in Vermont, I went to a small bookstore that was a wonderful, wonderful, very inspiring place. And I loved to spend time there with the woman who was working there, and we would have these nice conversations. And I purchased a copy of Swan's Way, and it was beautifully made, and it was a very good translation, the new translation, and I don't remember the name of the translator, but she became famous in and of herself. So I spent 6 months reading that, because I was told that I needed to read it slowly.
Thank you so much, Ginger, for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you. It's an honor.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.